Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's really good to see you all here, and glad that everyone is still here at the end of the meeting and after the events of last night, so it's nice to see a good group here. So I think we're all interested in crop centers of diversity. These are places where we see land races or traditional varieties of crops grown, as well as their crop wild relatives. And the interesting thing for me is that these genetic resources are actually conserved across the landscape, in situ, in farmers' fields, or in natural areas. So these land races and crop wild relatives often have a lot of important attributes. One is we think of them as a genetic resource for global agriculture, but also for the local farmers that are actually using them. They often have great cultural significance. So this is a picture of a painting by Diego Rivera in the Presidential Palace in Mexico. And it says down here at the bottom, El mundo debe a México, the world owes to Mexico, corn, beans, chili peppers, right? So this cultural significance of these centers of diversity really is hard to overstate. Often land races will have unusual kind of unique characteristics that are associated with local uses, particular land races that may be used for a particular dish, for instance. They can be more productive than improved varieties under particular conditions, and we'll show you some data about that. And the fact that they are being used in situ and grown in situ means that they are able to evolve over time to novel challenges, especially in these areas where seeds are saved and those populations really are continuing to evolve over time. Now, this evolution comes from multiple different evolutionary forces. And what's interesting in agricultural systems is you have this sort of natural side of that and then the human-mediated side. So we have, for instance, with gene flow, we can see natural hybridization happening between neighboring fields, for instance, but seed networks where farmers are actually exchanging seeds are a very important form of gene flow. With selection, we see natural selection by the environment, but we also have farmers making selection as they're saving seed and through their management as well. So it's the combination of these evolutionary forces that really produces the diversity that we see on the landscape and the patterns of genetic variation that we see there. So I'm really interested in some of the potential effects of climate change on land races, and we think of this warming, global warming that is occurring, also changes in precipitation and patterns of precipitation. And we see with models that we're expecting declines in agricultural production. We're already seeing changes in production and seeing farmers in different areas becoming very aware of climate change, including in the area where I'm working. And part of this is because of the shift in the sort of where agroecozones are going to be found. So this is some work that was done in Mexico. And if you look, it's in central Mexico here, but this is a blow up. And so if you focus, for instance, on the light blue, which is the highland agroecozone in that area, and you look at it in future predictions and even more extreme predictions, you can see that highland area really shrinking. And so anything that is adapted to that area is losing the environment that it's used to. And so, I'm really interested in implications for productivity and implications for these evolutionary processes as well. So to try to get at some of these questions about how, what's the effect of climate change on production, we use environmental gradients that can help us mimic climate change. So as you, for instance, in a mountain here, as you go up in elevation, you get to lower temperatures. Depending on what transect you're on, you could get higher or lower precipitation. But importantly, when you go up very quickly, you don't have any change in photo period, which if you're trying to make comparisons between environments is very useful with plants. So often we see in plant populations that we see local adaptation along environmental gradients, although what that looks like and the degree of local adaptation can vary quite a bit. And with these changing conditions, warmer temperatures, shifting precipitation, if we use reciprocal transplant experiments, where we move, say, plants that are used to this cooler highland area down into these warmer conditions at lower elevations, we can start to discern those patterns of local adaptation and the plastic responses to environmental change. So it's really like a kind of a space for time substitution to try to get at this question of response to environmental change. So what I want to talk to you today about today are some of the current patterns that we're seeing of local adaptation of land races, and speak specifically to sort of this, how do they handle warming conditions, or other sorts of environmental variation, and then what are some of the traits that we're investigating to think about what's underlying that adaptation. And this work is from work in Chiapas in southern Mexico, right there by the Guatemala border. And Chiapas is a great place to ask these kinds of questions. In a fairly small area, you can see pretty extreme, altitudinal variation up into the central highlands here. And what parallels that is temperature variation. The transect that we're working on, you don't actually see much change in precipitation along that transect, so we can kind of narrow down the variables that are changing as we go up in elevation. And this work is with Hugo Perales, who's based down there in San Cristobal. So we, for this work, we've made collections along a transect, as I mentioned, that goes from 2,050 meters down to 600 meters. And those are our highland and then midland at 1550 and lowland locations. And we wanted to inquire into the structure of the genetic variation that we were finding. So instead of just randomly collecting populations at these different elevations, we actually collected from three communities at each elevation, three populations within each community. So we could start to parse out, you know, whether a population from a given altitude is all the same and at sort of what level we're seeing genetic variation. We also included commercial varieties that are grown in Chiapas, and these genetic factors could be included as random factors in our models. And then we did reciprocal transplant experiments where we took all of that genetic material and planted them in all of the gardens so we could see how plants did in their own environment and also in environments that were foreign to them. So first I want to talk about these basic patterns of local adaptation that we're seeing. So on the y-axis here we have seed weight per emerged seedling. You can think of that as sort of yield per plant, on a per plant basis. Okay, and so what we see are these trends that are indicative of local adaptation. So some of them are trends and some of them are significant differences. But for local adaptation, we would be looking for the local type being the one that does best. So these different bars, we have the three here are the highland land races from coming from a cool highland environment, midland land races, lowland land races, and then the purple is the commercial varieties. So as you go up in elevation, you go from the lowland ones doing best under lowland conditions, the midland doing best under midland conditions, and the highland doing best under highland conditions. And again, some of these are trends rather than significant differences, but the patterns, even over multiple years, are consistent for overall adaptation, you know, sort of a overall fitness. We are seeing that different types that are grown under warmer conditions than they're used to are seeing reduced fitness. So not too much for this highland going into the midland garden, but certainly when going into the lowland garden in 2012, it really was quite a major decline into the midland garden because that was a very rough year in the midland garden with drought. But we are seeing that warming does reduce fitness, as does cooling though. So that's interesting as well. When we compare our commercial varieties to these land races, we see that they're most adapted to the warmest conditions, these lowland areas, and they're very similar to the lowland land races in their behavior in a lot of different ways. Sometimes they're slightly better, but it's actually not much of a difference. And when we look, just a quick aside, is that when we look at the variation in the varieties that we have of commercial varieties, some of them do better, and some of them actually do a lot worse than the lowland varieties. So this fitness variable that I've been showing you, this sort of individual yield, is composed of both survival to reproduction and then also seed production of those that survived to reproduce. And so if we look just at that survival to reproduction, I think it's an interesting contrasting pattern to see, Because what we're really seeing is that there's more differentiation of this trait under lowland conditions, and in fact only about 30% of the highland land races can produce any seed at all under lowland conditions. And so it's these sort of more moderate temperatures and conditions in the highlands where there's no difference in ability to reproduce, but you get down into the lowlands or get into very stressful years in the midlands and you really see this difference in and local adaptation comes through very clearly under these more lowland conditions. So we're seeing this asymmetry of response in this portion of the fitness trait, which has been interesting as well. And it relates to, I'm not showing you the ability to flower in different ways, but it relates to the ability to tassel versus ability to tassel and silk and ability then to produce seed. So I think that it's interesting that the survival variable really kind of highlights the issues that we might see with warming. And it's made us wonder, you know, how important is flowering time then to this variable in terms of producing the ability to produce seed at all. And in the highlands that have this an actually very long season, it might be the kind of environment that actually forgives different flowering time strategies. And I told you I showed you yield, so this is total seed weight produced. If we were to look at seed number, we would actually see those lowland types and the improved varieties looking much better because they have much smaller seeds and more seeds. They're more similar to the improved varieties that we have here in that way. And I mentioned those random factors, the genetic factors that we were trying to understand better. When we look at the variation among populations within communities and among communities within an elevation, we see more variation among populations within a community than we see among communities, which was surprising to us given the outcrossing nature of maize. We would figure that all these populations from within a community are similar, but that's not necessarily the case. We're also seeing more variation in flowering time variables than we are in fitness variables. So we're seeing the greatest variation in flowering time within populations. Within communities among populations, which is interesting to think that there's a bit more uniformity in ability to be adapted or just adaptation of these types to their different elevations, but maybe how they get there varies a bit. And flowering time obviously has implications for gene flow and separation of populations as well. So it's, again, coming up as an interesting trait. So we wanted to understand, you know, what are the traits that underlie adaptation? And I'm not going to get a chance to talk about everything that's going on in the lab. I have a student, Brian Pace, who's looking at physiological differences, biochemical differences. Had another student that has been doing work on genetic differences. I'm going to focus on some of the flowering time traits that we've been looking at. If I was to show you the data on flowering time, we'd be seeing that there's a lot of effect of environment on flowering time, with shorter flowering times in the warmer conditions. But the G by E is really quite mild, not much to write home about. So, but when we look at ASI, which is the difference in timing of the male and female flowers, we see real clear pictures of adaptation again. So once again, under lowland conditions, it's the lowland types that have the shortest ASI. In their midland conditions, the midlands have the shortest. Under highlands have the shortest. Or in some cases, they're that whatever's local is sort of equivalent to one of the other types. So we're seeing that ASI is coming through as a real clear indication of adaptation, which shouldn't be that surprising, given that it's been bred for in improved varieties, specifically to provide stress tolerance. And so that's kind of coming through here. But we wanted to see how these flowering time variables relate to fitness. So this is kind of a funky way of seeing correlations. We're not used to seeing them this way, so let me walk you through this. We have common garden elevation on the x-axis and then the correlation of these different flowering time variables with fitness on the y-axis. Tillering times are the squares, silking times are the circles, and the triangles are ASI. So I have 2 minutes, is that right? Okay, I'll try to get through this quick. So you can see these are all negative, so earlier flowering, shorter ASI increases fitness. One thing that was interesting is that you can see this sort of trend towards weaker associations under highland conditions. So it seems that at least in 2011 that there were slightly stronger associations with that on the lowland conditions. And that's still true for ASI over here. It's not true for the other variables, but still true for ASI except for this lowland type that has almost no association between ASI and fitness under lowland conditions. And I think it's this highland type's just doing so poorly that it didn't matter what their ASI was. They were just doing really badly. So we're trying to further understand these associations and also understand opportunities for selection in response to environmental change in these types. So I'm just going to zip through here. There's other things that we're looking at, and we're also looking at similar kinds of questions in chili pepper. But I will stop so there's maybe a hope of a question. But thank you very much.
Any questions? Yes.
So you have a different level of elevations in different environments. So did you guys consider to record the level of UV rays, like any photography, one thing? And did you consider to check the relationship between that UV rate along with the biochemical composition, because that's going to be very critical as the climate change or whatever next thing comes up.
Exactly. So I didn't show on that gradient. The other thing that changes, even though photoperiod doesn't change, UV does change along these elevational gradients. And actually, Brian here in the front is studying that for his dissertation work and trying to get into the biochemical side of it as well. So, yeah, that's a great point. Those are really important. And so if we think about genetic materials potentially having to shift into higher elevations to be adapted to these new conditions, I guess the question is, well, maybe they're good at the new temperature, but are they good at the new UV, or the old UV, I should say, levels, that there might be some issues there.
Especially the flavonoids, I think that would be a great point.
Great, yeah, actually that's what he's about to get some data on in the next few months. We wish to talk.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Next speaker.